This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Are you black first or a journalist first? That question was posed by an editor to a young reporter back in the 1980s who recounted that story just this week, describing it as a situation in which, quote, the editor had all the power and the young reporter just wanted the job. That young reporter grew up to be Cincinnati Inquirer columnist Byron McCauley, who joins us now on the phone. Byron, thank you for being with us again.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
Well, I want to talk about the context of being a black journalist while covering what's happening all across our nation, and certainly even here in the Cincinnati area. But before we dive into that, why don't you take us back to that period in your life when you were younger and up and coming in the business, and what was going on in that situation?
Well, I'd be glad to, Michael, and thank you so much for talking about this with me. That was a really interesting incident that I had. It was the first time that I'd been asked that, and it was actually my second newspaper job. I'd left a newspaper job from a larger paper that had won, you know, Pulitzer Prizes for covering the civil rights movement. So I moved to North Carolina after this interview, of course. But during the interview process, this editor asked me if I was black first or if I was a journalist first. And, you know, I had to ponder that a little bit because, you know, I'd been black all my life. I hadn't been a journalist all my life. So obviously I came to work as a young black man who had chosen to become a reporter as my occupation. And it was a hard question to answer, but I eventually, you know, I said, if you're asking me if I can be objective and fair and balanced in my reporting, I said, the answer is yes. And we sort of left it there, but it really impacted me because I didn't know how to feel about that guy really the whole time I worked there.
Was there anything in particular that maybe this editor was concerned about? Was there something happening?
Well, you know, the community that I was in was also a very historic community. And it had been actually the site of some of the first Woolworth sit-in. So it was a historic community, and, you know, it was kind of rare that I would be in a position there to do that. I mean, I was a business reporter and, you know, covering businesses. So I don't know what his thinking was. I don't know if he was trying to figure out if I could be objective or if I would have, you know, some kind of bias in my reporting. I said, but the fact is, when I thought about it, you know, I don't feel like he probably asked my colleagues, my white colleagues, the same question. So there was it was a sort of normal circumstance to be the journalist that, you know, they had always hired, as opposed to this new guy who was coming in who happened to be African American. So, you know, I didn't get a chance to ask him why, but as I reflect on what we're going through now in the country, where you have a lot of reporters of color who are covering this monumental and historic unrest that we have here, I found it just interesting to reflect upon again.
And we're talking with Byron McCauley, a columnist at the Cincinnati Inquirer. And Byron, I'm seeing across social media some similar circumstances expressed by journalists of color now. And it seems that these types of experiences are taking place in types of newsrooms that vary, whether they be television, radio, commercial, public, newspapers, large, small, new media. And you write that in the 80s when this happened, that it was an example of a lifetime of both overt and covert slights that eventually bleed like 100 little cuts. And you refer to it as a microaggression. And here we are, more than 30 years after that event that you experienced in a newsroom in North Carolina, and people are still having the same experiences, but now in the backdrop of some very serious unrest and some very serious questions about what this country is. What are your thoughts when you see journalists of the upcoming generation expressing experiences so similar to the one that you had all those years ago?
I wanted to bring that up because I wanted to show our audiences primarily that when you bring yourself to work, your whole self to work, and there are things that happen in the workplace that sometimes you sort of wonder, well, is this bigotry or is this just sort of normal? And the thing is, it's hard to figure that out because it's not always black and white. As a matter of fact, it sort of rests in the gray a lot. So best about young journalists coming up and maybe experiencing some of the things that I've gone through, I think it's a little bit different now because you have young journalists, for instance, journalists who are out in the field, say covering the unrest that's happening now. And there is a discussion among managers. Do you allow reporters who are trying to be objective and fair reporting to news to be active in showing their blackness, if you will, and wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt or joining the movement in their off time? So that is actually a discussion that's happening right now. Personally, I still try my best to abide by journalistic ethics, which basically says, avoid any appearance of impropriety or bias, which means you can cover, but you can't become the news or participate, be a participant in the action. I think that's something that's going to have to be discussed. People bring themselves to work, all of themselves. So I'm Plex, and I really look forward to seeing how we address this over time.
Well, it's interesting because, when you talk about journalistic ethics and making sure that you can cover a story without becoming part of the story, regardless of what you might feel one way or the other, what appears to be happening in many ways based on the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others in recent years, but these two in particular that have captured the nation's attention right now, is it's raising so many other issues that Black people feel in so many different parts of society. And so if a journalist of color is able to go out into the field and do the traditionally ethical type of reporting that we would expect, it doesn't mean necessarily that they should come back into their newsroom and settle for experiencing what you describe as microaggressions. So how are we seeing the industry, the journalism industry, respond to this moment from that respect?
So, Michael, I think that the industry has to take a long, hard look at the people, at the behavior and the how to ask how their people of color are doing, and really be very aware of the stress and, frankly, I think the trauma that journalists of color covering a situation like this may go through. Whether it's, when you're not a journalist, or when you're away from work, you're someone else and you live your life as that person. But when you're working, there are sort of credentials. There's an expectation that you're going to, go out and bravely cover the news. I think the industry really needs to, one, make sure they hire more journalists of color to cover some of these issues that we're starting to cover in that that's going to be on our radar for a very long time and probably should have been long ago. So I think you need hire all types of people with all types of experiences. But I think it's especially important to hire journalists of color who have a perspective, who understand, make sure they know what our ethical boundaries are, but also take special care in understanding how they come to work. We come to work as a person of color. And when you look at things that are being committed against people of color that we're talking about, the Floyd case and a lot of the Breonna Taylor case, you know, that impacts people of color in many, many ways. I feel a personal burden, and I also feel a personal sort of engagement with that. You know, that could have been my mother or brother or aunt. So I feel a different way about that, and I understand how people can feel when they want to express themselves, and it manifests itself in what we're going through right now.
And you're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer columnist Byron McCauley. And Byron, you write about the way that journalists of color live in two different worlds, one where they cover the events of the day, but they also know what discrimination is and they know what racism is. And I've seen some posts and some commentary and some articles written by journalists of color expressing how heavy it all feels right now. Mm-hmm. And you sort of just touched on that moments ago. What are you hearing in that community from journalists of color and the difficulties of covering the moment and experiencing the moment from that perspective?
So I have been talking with some of my colleagues who've actually been out in the field, actually covering the unrest that we've seen in the past few days, and even nationwide. And I've even corresponded with the journalist in Pittsburgh who was actually taken off coverage of the protests in her town because of a perceived because a social media post that she made was perceived to be biased, so her editors took her off that. A lot of my colleagues have really expressed weariness and sadness and a range of emotions after coming back from actually covering some of the protests and feeling weary over a lot of the things that have happened, you know, the incident that happened in Minnesota that we all saw. It really sort of takes its toll. And when I talked earlier about making sure your journalists of color are okay, I feel like there needs to be a real check-in to make sure that, you know, some of the things that they're experiencing, and maybe as a totality of their lives, that maybe they've experienced discrimination, that we really need to be able to understand and appreciate and provide, you know, help with, you know, having your EQ activated in a heightened sense. So that's one of the things I have seen some of my colleagues and myself too. I had a moment last week where I just felt like this is just too much. I have to separate myself from what I'm writing and reading and seeing and just, you know, try to go back to being a human, to the routine a little bit, because it's hard to escape.
Byron, I don't want to veer too far from your column, but if you can answer this, we're talking about journalism and the Black experience, and we're doing that because of the unrest that emerged in response to the killings of Black people at the hands of police. And so we're talking about the impact on the industry we both work in, but there's so many other things that are happening because of this. You know, some are large and some are small, some are policy driven, some are cultural. We're seeing, you know, the elimination of no-knock warrants in Louisville based on this. That's a significant policy change in direct relation, but we're seeing NASCAR ban Confederate flags from their events. We're seeing Starbucks change their minds today and allowing their employees to wear Black Lives Matters materials while in the workplace. We're seeing Confederate memorabilia and statues removed, with people of all partisan stripes saying that it's time to do that. What do you think is so different about this moment we're going through right now today? When we look back over the past decade at instances in which Black people were killed by police, and there were uprisings, there were marches and anger, and then there were different periods where we were upset about where the Confederate flag was flying or a Confederate statue might be, or policies at work that felt discriminatory. All of these things were compartmentalized. It seemed like we would address them for that period and move on, and then something else would flare up. But now all of this is happening at once. What's different about this moment, do you think, when you look back at history?
That's a great question. I think this moment, like the moment that the public saw the body of Emmett Till after he was taken in Mississippi, I think the variable, the one thing that happened here was that we saw a man who was killed in front of our eyes, or at least we think we saw his death. I mean, he stopped breathing in front of our eyes, and it was broadcast around the world, and it brought to everyone's attention, and I think consciousness, that this happened. This is real. This happened before our eyes. And we can't move forward with closed eyes anymore. We have to do something. And I think that triggered a lot of soul searching, not just in police community relations, but also in all the things that you just mentioned, Michael. I think it just was one of those seminal moments in time that triggers something larger than the routine, that triggers something larger than what we can even imagine and control. It really made us go into our collective consciousness and say, we have to change things now, move forward together, and not perish apart. So I think that's what you're going to see now. And when we talked about earlier getting, diverse journalists cover this, this is really, I feel like, a new sort of social justice or civil rights moment that will be with us for a while. And so that's what I think happened. We actually saw it with our eyes, and it shocked our systems to action.
And we're seeing outrage in the suburbs about what has long happened in the cities. We've seen it in Erlanger. We've seen it in Westchester. And in police departments in Westchester during events, we saw those police officers kneel with some of the people attending that rally in solidarity. And you have another column out this week. Don't miss an opportunity to reach back when police reach out. And I've seen some mixed responses to coverage of police joining in, because there's also been obviously some very violent responses at the hands of law enforcement to these protests that emerged because of violence at the hands of police officers. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on the importance of recognizing when to take a knee together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's easy to look at a police officer reaching out or trying to, embed or participate in the common, struggle, for lack of a better word, to be cynical and say, well, that's a PR moment. I think that we must welcome moments like that, because The fact is, we all rely on police to be there when you dial 911 and they respond, or to manage traffic, to make sure that, you know, when you have a break-in, that they're there. So we all depend on that. There are definitely good, most of the police officers are not going to be the type that are going to, you know, actively harm someone in the way that we saw Mr. Floyd dying. But that's why I think it's important that we make sure that we reach back when police reach to us. I mention that because the church that I go to, you know, held a walk, and the police officers that we've had a relationship with, the police departments, Forest Park and Springdale, that we've had a relationship with for a very long time. So we know these guys, and they know us. And I think that's where change happens, so that you're not coming toward someone as an adversary or as a suspected, you know, criminal, but you're coming to interact with one another as you know, almost like peers and as community. I think that's where it's going to have to start. So I do think that we must reach out when they reach out. At the same time, there is going to be room, and there needs to be, and we see it, obviously, the system needs reform. I talked about people saying that they, you know, defund police. Well, I think that's probably going a little bit. I think the messaging needs to be a little bit different. I think it should be reform and police differently. So I do believe, though, that we need to make sure we, you know, we reach out when they reach out and form a better relationship in that way.
Byron McCauley is a columnist at the Cincinnati Inquirer, and that is where you can read his columns online or in print. Byron, thank you so much for coming back on and sharing some perspective with us. We really appreciate it.
Michael, thank you so much.
We'll talk again soon.
Okay. Take good care now.
You too. Cincinnati City Council will discuss a proposed budget that, despite recent doom and gloom, doesn't include furloughs or layoffs. So what is in it? And what isn't? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. When the pandemic hit, Cincinnati City Hall announced the furlough of hundreds of workers across nearly all departments. But as the city is poised to adopt the budget for the next fiscal year, it looks like all workers could be back. So joining us now to talk about it are Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. She's on the phone with us. Sherry, welcome back.
Good to talk to you.
And we also have WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Michael.
Okay, Sherry, I recall talking to you not too long ago as this pandemic really started to take hold of the local economies and the struggle that Cincinnati City Hall was having and letting hundreds of people go for the time being. What's different now compared to then as this new budget that starts July 1st is crafted?
Well, I think we were expecting really to see layoffs for the first time. There's always doom and gloom. But this is the first time, and you know, oh, there might be layoffs, and then there never are. But this time, you know, I think there was a real fear that that was going to be true. I mean, they said in budget committee meetings, it could be police and firefighters. And so that was really something that everyone was looking for in the budget, and that turned out not to be true. And to be fair, to get through, they did borrow $25 million. But as a result, there are absolutely no layoffs in the city workforce.
Now, of course, from a policy perspective, this is the budget that is presented for consideration by the council. So when do we expect the conversation at the council level to begin?
Well, I think we're definitely starting to see it already popping up on social media. It's that kind of world that we live in now. But, you know, the real conversations are going to be next week. There's two public hearings for the first time. The public's really going to be able to see council thanks to the coronavirus pandemic. The public has not been allowed inside City Hall, but there's a lot of mechanisms for people to speak next week at two different public hearings. And then there'll be City Council, too. And so the conversation's really going to unfold very quickly next week with the idea that they have to pass something by June 30th.
Jay Hanselman, this budget is not without spending reductions. There was a $73.4 million deficit at one point, and according to your reporting, there were a variety of efforts to close that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Sherry mentioned most part of the deficit is being covered by the potential to borrow $25 million, an emergency one-time loan, which ironically is allowed in state laws during a pandemic, and that was put there in the 1900s during the Spanish flu pandemic. And so the city is using that now to cover $25 million. They're also anticipating receiving at least $15 million from the state of Ohio, which comes to the state thanks to the CARES Act passed by Congress. And then you're right, there are about $32.5 million worth of cuts. Some of those are leaving vacant positions empty. There's also some non-personnel cuts and some moving some general fund or operating funding to restricted funds that are, that have a little bit more defined purpose that that they're able to do that with. But Sherry talked about, you know, it is amazing that you can, I think $73 million is the largest deficit that I've ever written about. And there were reports that at one time it could be $100 million. And the mere fact that they're doing that without furloughs and layoffs is pretty amazing. But let's not forget, I mean, there are going to be some vacant positions that will not be filled. And there was a report this morning that they're going to offer this early retirement program for some city workers. There's about 500 eligible. So even if half took advantage of that, you could have well over, you know, 300 workers either retiring early or positions that will remain empty. So I know the city manager has said the last couple of years, city departments need to do more with less. But some departments are getting to the point that you're going to be doing more with a whole lot less. And at some point, that has to have an impact on the delivery of services.
Sherry, help us understand where the streetcar stands with this particular budget. We know it's been operating still, but without riders during the pandemic. What can we expect as this budget is considered?
Well, David Mann is calling it the zombie streetcar, and I think that's a phrase that's going to catch on. You know, during the pandemic, it was closed to passengers and remains closed. And for what is being called safety reasons, there is a clamoring for it to reopen along with everything else, a conversation that I believe will also begin unfolding next week. But with everything that is happening and all with this $73 million deficit, the mayor did not and the city manager did not feel like that was, you know, numbers they wanted to put into the budget, and they did not fund the entire thing. Parking revenue way off because nobody was going downtown. And saying the casino closed and all of these things, these revenue drops, and they just said they cannot make this streetcar work. And so it is not in the budget. I can't even believe it's probably going to be one of the number one things talked about next week, because this council is going to want to put it back in and they're going to have to find the money. And that's going to mean cuts that we haven't seen yet, because they're going to have to come from some other place. Or the idea of just straight up borrowing the money to keep the streetcar running. And so I do think this is going to be, you know, a big issue next week, which is kind of unbelievable, but it's still the main conversation about the budget.
Well, it wouldn't be a city council meeting, I suppose, without talking about this. And
Michael, can I jump in on the streetcar there real quick? Because Sherry mentioned David Mann. Our friend Chris Wetterick at the Business Courier talked to Councilmember Mann, and I'm curious to see if what he told Chris holds true, that he's thinking that perhaps council will pass the budget with the streetcar funding that is there, which basically maintains the status quo with no passenger service, and then comes along later in the fiscal year, July, August, September, and then decides how to handle whether there will be passenger service. But one thing we do know, the streetcar ordinance is a separate ordinance all by itself. That's important because I would say there's a high likelihood that any streetcar ordinance that were to restart passenger service would face a certain veto from Mayor John Cranley, and it would take six council members to override that veto. So they have to have at least six votes if they want to bring passenger service back, unless there would be some sort of grant funding from the state or the federal transit folks who I don't think anyone would turn down free money to operate the streetcar if it were made available.
And I want to point
also.
No, please go ahead,
Sherry. It'll be the first time that we hear from our new council members on the issue of the streetcar. Jan Michelle Lemon Curry, who replaced Tamaya Denard, and Betsy Thunderman, who replaced Amy Murray, they haven't had the fun discussions about the streetcar yet. So we'll kind of see, you know, what they have to say and where they fall on it.
Well, we'll be having a fun discussion about the streetcar in our next segment. We recorded it this morning with Inquirer reporter Hannah Sparling, and that explores the recently approved regional transportation plan from the Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana Regional Council of Governments, which includes a note of how much it would cost to connect the streetcar to Newport, Kentucky. So that's coming up after this. And another thing that we talk about with Hannah is about events returning to convention centers and how there's not any event scheduled at the Duke Energy Center. But Jay, there are a couple of meetings where the public can participate and share their concerns about the budget, right?
Correct. There are budget hearings on Tuesday and Thursday starting at 6 o'clock at the Duke Energy Convention Center. The details are laid out on the city's website, cincinnati-oh.gov. They are going to limit in-person. You can talk in-person, offer your testimony in-person, but they're going to limit that to 300 people. So once those 300 slots are gone, they will cut off entrance to the convention center, as I understand the rules. You do have the option of commenting virtually via Zoom, and you have to sign up and make an appointment for that. Again, that's on the website, and I think what they do, they will call you in advance of when your allotted time is and have you basically in queue, but then you would have your 2 minutes to address the Budget and Finance Committee just if you were there in person. And you can either do that, as David Mann said, where they can see, in his words, your mug as you address them, or you can join by basically a conference call if you want to participate in the budget hearings.
And you are listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're joined now by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Sherry, the issue of the protest downtown received a vote at City Hall. It looks like City Council is supportive of leniency for the people who were arrested for curfew violations. We know there were a lot of people arrested. A lot of them complained about the way they were treated by police and by the sheriff's department at the jail. What was the situation here?
You know, this was a very, you know, in-depth conversation at City Hall. The people who were arrested for violating the curfew, and we're talking about 500 people, they face a misdemeanor of the first degree charge, which is punishable by up to six months in jail and up to $1,000 fine. And, you know, that's a pretty scary prospect for a lot of these people. It's their first arrest. And council is just like, you know, that is not the direction we want to go in. And so they put forward a motion, which is not binding, but it's how they express their wishes. And it did prompt a big conversation. In the end, they did vote to really, you know, express their wishes that these charges be dropped, these people be allowed to go in diversion, with a variety of different things. But the end result of each of the things is leniency. And that did not thrill Dan Hills, the FOP president.
And Jay, this was not a unanimous vote by council.
No, the final vote in council was 7-2, with council members Mann and Sunderman opposing. And they were more concerned about a couple things, that in the future, if the city declares a curfew, it needs to have some teeth that it can be enforced, that, you know, folks who violate the curfew, if they're one in the future, know that there could be some ramifications, and not that city council will come along and try to blanketly dismiss those charges. And then they were also concerned that the city solicitor is the city's chief legal officer, and basically she has the final say on how these cases are prosecuted, and they were not thrilled that a council member was expressing an opinion to the city solicitor about how she should handle these cases.
When do we expect those cases to move forward? Are they all sort of individually processed through the court system now, or is there a plan for some mass handling of them?
You know, I don't know about that. I think the folks have made their initial appearance, but I'm not sure of the process moving forward. You know, like you said, there are four different options that these folks can choose from. A couple things we need to say, too. If someone was charged with a curfew violation and some other charge, they're not and were not included in this motion. And they don't have to take the four options. If they choose, they can, you know, go through with a court case if they want. And that could even include, you know, a trial if they choose to do that.
And Jay, we're talking about the budget and the way the city is dealing with its financial constraints amid this pandemic. These protests have been costly in the way of police overtime, right?
Right. For just the first 2 days of the protest, and part of this is lagging information because of the city's pay periods, but we do have the data from the first 2 days of the protest, which were May the 29th and May the 30th. That was more than $400,000. Don't hold me. I think it was like maybe $425,000, $426,000 total. But again, that includes just 2 days. So when, you know, we have multiple days after that that will be reported later this month. So it's entirely possible that, you know, in addition to balancing next year's budget, this year's budget also had a small deficit of about $2 million. That was before this overtime. So it could be that at the last few days of the month, city officials will be scrambling to make sure that the current budget is balanced by June the 30th.
And Sherry, the chairman of the Citizen Complaint Authority, which oversees complaints against police in the city, says that there are some serious complaints against police during these protests, right?
You know, they had a special meeting of the CCA, which is being fully funded in the new budget. For years, they've been short investigating. We're super behind on the cases, more than 100, I think, at this point. And, you know, the idea of transparency and police oversight, I mean, the Citizens Complaint Authority is considered one of the best in the nation because it offers, you know, it's really the citizen oversight, and it's a board of people. But afterwards, the new board chair, he was direct and honest. He said there's 25 complaints that came in during the protests, and five of them are serious enough for the investigators to actually look at. And my understanding, you know, we have a public records request in to kind of take a look at these. I'm not sure. I think until they're substantiated, not sure we're going to be able to see those, but we're kind of looking into that. But whatever they are, there's five serious, is his word, cases.
And we will have a robust conversation about these issues on Tuesday, June 16th, here on Cincinnati Edition. We've got Mayor John Cranley talking about the collaborative agreement. We will have the chairman of the Citizens Complaint Authority, and we'll also hear from police and the police union. That's Tuesday, June 16th at noon here on 91.7 WVXU. And our last minute or so that we have together, Sherry, what's going on with the health commissioner, Melba Moore, and the vote that Cincinnati City Council gave to her in the form of confidence?
You know, this was a super rare vote, but there has been a lot of behind-the-scenes consternation about Commissioner Moore, honestly a beloved figure in the community, was placed in charge of the pandemic only, which, of course, you know, that is maybe a very busy and important job right now. But day-to-day operations of the health department had been given to another member of the health department. And a lot of people didn't like that. I mean, the words one of the unions used was stripped of her power. And there was even, these council even held a hearing in which, you know, they wanted to know what was going on. They do not control the health board, but they control the spending. And they were concerned about, you know, a lot of employees being concerned about this. And so, council, I cannot remember them taking a vote of confidence in any other city leader, no matter how many things really have been going on. And so they did unanimously say they support her in an actual vote.
Sherry Coolidge is with the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Jay Hanselman is from right here at WVXU. Thanks to both of you. Look forward to a time soon when we're all back in the studio together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The newly adopted regional transportation plan includes some familiar ideas like the Brent Spence Bridge and the Western Hills Viaduct, as well as a pretty impressive new idea, possibly connecting the streetcar in downtown Cincinnati to Newport. And the first event at the Sharonville Convention Center is planned for this weekend since the pandemic began, that is. And it's a gun show. Here to talk about it is Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Hannah Sparling. Hannah, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
So this transportation plan includes some regular hits. It's something that is updated fairly regularly by the Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana Regional Council of Governments. And so we do see some familiar hits on there as well as some new things. First, let's talk about what this means. This isn't a list of projects that are now in the pipeline, right?
Yeah. So basically what it is OKI is required by the federal government to do this plan. And they have to do a new one at least every 4 years, but they kind of update it more regularly than that. And it's just a look at, it's not what's definitely going to come, but it's a look at kind of their best idea of what might come tied to the funding that's available. So if there's something they want, but it costs way too much money, that can't be on the list. It has to be a plan that would fit within the financial constraints they expect.
And so, as I mentioned, the Brent Spence Bridge, sort of the lingering project for the past decade and a half, it is on there. Is there anything new about the idea that's in this particular plan that was adopted on Thursday?
Well, it's not exactly new, but I think it might still be a surprise to some people. But there is something in the plan to extend the streetcar from Cincinnati over to Newport. So I think it's a roughly $97 million project in the plan. So that's actually been in there before. But it's in there again, which I think is interesting because there's so much going on with Cincinnati streetcar right now. It's actually not even open to passengers. So the thought of expanding that just seems it's extra interesting right now.
And I think that it's interesting that the proposal was pushed by a Newport City Commissioner, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's Beth Fennell, who's also on the OKI board. And
she's on the OKI board. So the way this plan works is that in order for a project to get federal funding of any kind, it has to be in the plan. And so she said she's aware of everything that's going on with Cincinnati streetcar right now. And her main goal was just to get this project into the plan just so that that it's eligible for federal funding. So they're not doing much more with it right now.
We should note that there are some projects that would excite people who like the idea of multimodal transportation. That is to suggest any type of transportation that doesn't involve your car. So bicyclists and pedestrians and runners. I mean, a lot of trails around the region got some love in this thing.
Yeah, there was a ton of trail stuff in there. The bulk is still for highways, which I think is pretty standard. But yeah, if you like to run or walk or ride a bike, there's some stuff in there for you. There's also plenty of public transportation stuff. I think some people might be excited to see the bus rapid transit plans in there. There were four different bus rapid transit plans in here. So well, I think that's good to see.
Well, let's talk about both those things. Where could we expect some trails if any of these projects were able to get some funding? I know some of these trails have been announced and are planned or some pieces have been completed, but there are a lot of them that looks like they could be improved upon.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is improving upon existing trails and existing plans. There's a lot along the Ohio River. In Kentucky, the Licking River Greenway is in there, so that would be a 14-mile trail connecting Covington, Taylor Mill, Wilder, and Newport. So just things kind of closer to downtown is where most of it was. There was some out in the suburbs, but I would say it was kind of centered downtown.
And for those who aren't familiar, there are two different trails that have been constructed in some pieces on the northern Kentucky side. There's Riverfront Commons, which also got some love in this plan. That stretches basically east-west along the Ohio Riverfront cities in northern Kentucky. Then the Licking River Trail is mostly, I guess, entirely in the Covington side of the Licking River right now. But this plan suggests that there could be a bridge that's connected to Wilder, and that would be for pedestrians. So that was an interesting note. I was also interested by the CVG airport loop. What exactly was that?
Yeah, and there's not too much detail in this plan.
Right.
So just basically, it is what it says, kind of finishing. There's some sort of trail out there now, I believe, and so I think it's just finishing and adding on to that.
Okay, and then let's talk about other public transportation that you thought would get people who care about that sort of thing excited.
Yeah, sure. So Hamilton County, as you know, just passed a big levy for public transit, estimated at $130 million a year. Now that might change with the coronavirus. But so in the plan, but part of the sales pitch to sell that levy was doing some bus-only lanes. And in the plan, it talks about four different ones on Montgomery Road, Hamilton Avenue, Glenway Avenue, and Reading Road. So I think people would be excited to see those kind of moving forward, just like it was promised.
And we're talking with Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Inquirer. And we noted at the beginning that the Prince-Pence Bridge makes its regular appearance in this plan. A lot of people who oppose the bridge for a variety of different reasons have found themselves in support of a project called the Cincinnati Eastern Bypass, which would basically take people through the suburbs of northern Kentucky over into the eastern part of the southwest Ohio suburbs. The Eastern Bypass is not in the plan, right?
That's correct, and that's important because that means the Eastern Bypass can't get federal funding. And based on some estimates that say it would cost around $5 billion to build, that it would definitely need federal funding. So I think, you know, this list can be updated, so that's not saying the Eastern Bypass is dead for good, but at least for right now, it is saying it's not in the minds of the people who are kind of managing these transportation projects for our area.
Okay, and you can read that full report at the Inquirer in the article by Hannah Sparling. Also, the Sharonville Convention Center is going to be hosting its first event this weekend since everything shut down due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is a gun show. What can you tell us about this event?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned it's the first event taking place at the convention center since everything shut down for the coronavirus. It's a gun show. It's kind of a regular fixture at the Sharonville Convention Center. The man who runs it told me they go there, I think, 9 times a year is what he said. So it was the last event before the shutdown, and it'll be the first one back. He said, which I found interesting, that he's expecting actually larger crowds this weekend. It takes place Saturday and Sunday. And he thinks that more people are going to come out because of the George Floyd protest. He said basically that in his business with guns, any kind of unrest nationwide drives up gun sales, and he's expecting that to happen this weekend as well.
And he told you in this article that a similar situation happened after the shooting of all those kids at Sandy Hook Elementary, that suddenly gun business picked up.
Yeah, and that one, the connection there is a little easier to understand, I think, because that was, you know, a tragedy that involved guns. And so people were afraid there would be new legislation involving guns, and so they kind of rushed out to buy guns. Here, the connection's a little less clear, but basically he said any kind of chaos or unrest drives his business up.
Well, there are some guidelines that have to be followed still. So regardless of the crowd size, we are still in the middle of a pandemic. And I thought it was interesting to note that there aren't specific guidelines from the state regarding convention centers. So who's assisting them with how to try to keep people as safe as they can?
Sure. So they've been talking with the health department. And while there's not a guideline for convention centers, what they're doing basically is just adapting the guidelines for whatever event they're doing. So when they do food guidelines, they use kind of the guidelines for restaurants or banquets. In this case, they're using the retail guidelines for the gun show. So they're doing kind of a monitored entrance exit. So as one person comes out, another person's allowed in. So if there is a big crowd, it might be just a lot more people waiting in the parking lot. They kind of space things out inside, so wider aisles, tables spaced farther apart to allow people to social distance. And then just the regular, you know, hand sanitizing stations, signs reminding people to stay farther apart and to wash their hands.
As for the Duke Energy Center downtown, the downtown convention center, we don't know much about events that could be coming there, do we?
Yeah, so when I wrote this article, their website wasn't updated. It had some events listed coming up, but when you clicked into those events, you found out they really weren't happening. It's since been updated, so it looks like they're maybe having some things come back in August.
Hannah Sparling is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. We appreciate you so much taking some time to chat with us, Hannah. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of our show is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. The composer of our theme music is Rob Vetters. As always, you can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. Have a great weekend. We are back live on Monday. I'm Michael Monks.